Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a savory sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and crispy hash browns. With McDonald's Mix and Match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
If a friend asks how you're doing, and you say,
I'm okay.
When the truth is,
I don't want my problems to burden anyone.
Or you say,
hang in there.
Because
if I ask for help, they'll just think I'm weak.
Then this is your sign to call, text, or chat. 988 for free, confidential support. Anytime. You don't have to hide how you feel.
Welcome to the Crux True Survival Podcast. Today we embark on a frigid expedition to the heart of Antarctica, where an Australian explorer's relentless pursuit of discovery and survival carved his legacy into the icy landscape. This is the story of Douglas Mawson, an unwavering spirit who faced the harshest of conditions to unveil the secrets of the frozen continent. Douglas Mawson led what became known as the most terrible polar exploration of all time.
Ooh, sounds chilling.
Chilling and chilly. Reading this story makes me cold just thinking about it. So Douglas Mawson was a lesser known Antarctic explorer in the age of Antarctic exploration, right in there with Ernest Shackleton, Robert Falcon Scott, Roald Amundsen. Back in the early 1900s, these explorers were all racing to map Antarctica, find the most southerly point of the continent, reach the magnetic South Pole. And Douglas Mawson was part of that quest. So he had been on an exploration with Ernest Shackleton between 1908 and 1909, and was actually one of the three people to first reach the Earth's magnetic South Pole. So he already kind of had a name for himself before he went on to lead his own expedition a few years later in 1912. He had been invited by a more well-known explorer, Robert Falcon Scott, to join an expedition that was racing to reach the most southerly point on Antarctica. But he decided to turn down that invitation in favor of putting together and leading his own expedition, which ended up being a good decision because Robert Falcon Scott's expedition, they did reach the most southerly point of Antarctica, but another team had reached that point 34 days before them. So they lost the race. And then the whole entire party of five men ended up dying on the return journey from the pole. So nobody survived that.
Right, including Robert Falcon Scott.
Yep, they all perished. Those and photographs were found by a search party about 8 months later. Nobody knew what happened to them until they were later found. So despite the horrific story I'm about to tell you, it was better than what could have happened if he had taken the invitation to go with this other team.
Before you go on, I just have to ask you if you think Robert Falcon Scott, if he actually put that falcon in the middle of his name just to sound more adventuresome. I was just thinking you would be Julie Falcon Hennings.
Yes, I would. Why would you not throw a falcon in the middle of your name to just give you that edge?
Right. I love it.
I do too. That was brilliant on his part.
No one will ever forget that name.
No, including me. I was actually surprised I'd never heard of this guy when I was researching this story. I mean, most of people have heard of Ernest Shackleton and the Endurance, and we've talked about it on this podcast. But yeah, this is a pretty amazing, lesser known, but equally brutal story. So Douglas Mawson wanted to map the part of Antarctica that lies just south of Australia, due south. And nobody had ever set foot on that land. The coastline had been mapped previously, but no one had ever actually gotten out of a boat and tried to cross on foot. So he raised money to pay for this expedition for about a year. He gathered money from the British and Australian governments. He was British, but had lived his entire life in Australia. He moved there when he was a kid, so really was more Australian than British. And he also raised money from commercial interests with mining and whaling. And in about a year's time, he raised the equivalent of today, what would be $16.7 million. So a lot of money.
That's a ton of money. It's hard to imagine that.
Yeah, I guess it was a big deal back then to figure out what was going on in Antarctica. So people were willing to pay. So he gathered this group of men. They headed south from Australia, from Hobart, Australia. And within a couple weeks, they hit Antarctica. They had to look around a little bit for a place to set up a base camp because it was mostly icy cliffs that they were encountering and really no good access to get on land. But eventually they found a bay with some rocky beach called Commonwealth Bay. And he set up a camp right inside that bay that he named Cape Denison. Denison was one of the big financial contributors to the exploration.
Is this happening in the summer season in Antarctica? Is that when most of these explorations are happening?
Yes. Yeah. So this was, they set out on November 10th, 1912, and I think they arrived in early December, which is summertime there. So they set up this camp, this really rustic, cold, uncomfortable wooden huts. That was their base camp. And in one quote, Douglas Mawson describes what it was like to step outside the hut in a midwinter blizzard. And this is what he said. A plunge into the writhing storm whirl stamps upon, okay. A plunge into the writhing storm whirls stamps upon the senses and an indelible and awful impression seldom equaled in the whole gamut of natural experience. The world of void, grisly, fierce, and appalling. We stumble and struggle through the gloom, the merciless blast, an incubus of vengeance, stabs, buffets, and freezes. The stinging drifts, blinds, and chokes.
Sounds inviting.
So don't totally understand. Yeah, that's definitely like 1912 speak, but in any case, it sounds awful and cold.
Terrible.
So temperatures while they were there could get as low as negative 77 degrees Fahrenheit. So cold. Wind speeds averaged 50 miles per hour, but sometimes topped 200 miles per hour. Blizzards were almost constant. There was a meteorological station that recorded an annual average wind speed of 80 kilometers per hour, 50 miles per hour. So just cold and windy all the time. There's some pictures you can see online of Douglas Mawson leaning into the wind, and he's standing upright at a 45 degree angle because the wind is holding him up. It's pretty telling.
What kind of gear did they have? What kind of parkas were they wearing? Do you know?
Yes. So back in those days, I mean, it was wool, and wool absorbed snow and was damp and just really impossible to dry out. The gear alone made this even more challenging than what it would be like today. And also, like, the food they had to eat, they carried this stuff called pemmican. It's a high energy food that's really unappetizing. Rendered fats and tallows mixed with dried meat, sometimes berries. It was a calorie rich food that could help give them the calories they needed, but still be packable and portable and be preserved. But, you know, just sounds awful to eat. So there were gear issues, there were food challenges, just nothing was pleasant about what they were setting out to do. So Douglas Mawson was the leader. He split his expedition into four different groups of men. One group would stay at base camp, and then the other three would separate and head into the interior of Antarctica and do the scientific work that they planned to do. So he assigned himself to the riskiest of those three exploration groups. It was a group called the Far Eastern Shore Party. They had the greatest distance to go and therefore had to carry the heaviest loads to cover that distance. And the nature of the terrain on that particular route was really dangerous, crevasse covered, hard traveling. So he picked two other men to go with him as part of this Far Eastern Shore Party. There was an explorer by the name of Xavier Mertz. He was a Swiss mountaineer and ski champion, really good on skis. And Lieutenant Belgrave Ninnis, who was a 23-year-old British Army officer. So pretty young. This guy was 23 years old. Douglas Mawson was a little bit older. But Belgrave Ninnis and Xavier Mertz joined Douglas Mawson. And they brought 12 dogs, husky dogs. They were going to pull dog sleds or sledges, they call them, and two sledges. So 12 dogs, two sledges that carried all their gear, 1,700 pounds of gear that they were bringing, food, wow, tents, scientific equipment, survival gear. And this would all get pulled on the sledges by the dogs. They headed out from Cape Denison to start exploring on November 10th, 1912. And things were going actually pretty good at first. They traveled 300 miles by December 13th. So that's like over or close to 10 miles a day, which is pretty good over glaciers and crevasses, dog sleds. They were battling through frequent blizzards. And throughout that time, they had to cross two really large and dangerous glaciers. The glaciers later became named Mertz and Ninnis glaciers, which might be a little foreshadowing as to what happened to Mertz and Ninnis.
Yeah, I'm assuming it's not positive.
It's not positive. They did get glaciers named after them, but that was a real consolation prize for what happened to him. So anyway, after about a month of travel, they reached a point about 310 miles from their base camp at Cape Denison, having crossed these dangerous glaciers. And like I said, things were going pretty good at first, but then there was a series of peculiar incidences that Mawson had later noted in his journal that just gave him a sense of foreboding. They were worried that their luck was going to run out. And the first incident was Mawson had a really strange dream one night, and his father had appeared in his dream and was sickly and not in good health. And he later came to realize that this dream occurred shortly after his father had unexpectedly got sick and died back in Australia. He had been in good health when Mawson left Australia, so it was unexpected, and this dream occurred. And then another thing that happened that just freaked them all out was one day the three explorers found that one of their husky dogs, who had been pregnant, had given birth to the puppies and was devouring her own puppies, eating them after she had given birth to them, which was really disturbing and unsettling.
Those are the best words to describe that right there.
Yeah. Apparently, this is not abnormal for dogs, husky dogs, in really extreme conditions like this. And I think they knew that, but nonetheless, doesn't make that any easier to see. And then the third incident that he described was one day out of nowhere, petrel, which is a kind of a sea bird, had flown and smashed into the side of Belgrave Ninnis's sledge, which was really weird. Like, where did it come from? Why would it fly right into the sledge? Just an odd incident. And if you look into what petrels are known as, the lore surrounding petrel birds. They're known as a harbinger of death or the devil's bird. They just don't usually indicate good times ahead. Some sailors will say that sighting petrels means a storm is coming or rough roads ahead. So that was not a good incident.
Are those birds scavengers?
I don't know. I don't know if they are. Actually, I had to look them up. I'd never heard of petrel. These peculiar incidents, and then just things started getting difficult, as you might expect them to. They were having a bunch of near misses for plunging into these cracks in the ice. They really had to be careful of where they went, their route. Mawson suffered a bad split lip. That doesn't sound like that big of a deal, but in these cold and windy temperatures, it just was extremely painful, shooting pain across his whole face. It wouldn't heal. Ninnis developed an episode of snow blindness, which isn't surprising. And he also developed an abscess on the tip of one finger that was really painful and ended up having to be lanced with a pocket knife without any kind of anesthetic. So just some of the things that you might expect to happen, but are not fun and certainly challenging to deal with in that environment. So eventually, on the evening of December 13th, so 310 miles in, a month in, they had gone through enough of their rations that they decided to abandon one of their sledges and redistribute the load onto the remaining two sledges. I think I said they brought two sledges, they actually brought three. So, but now they had enough gear, they can consolidate it on two of the sledges. And here's where they made a critical error. They put most of their food, their tent, a lot of their really essential equipment on one of the sledges, and then some food and a lot of scientific equipment and less critical things for survival on the second sledge. And I bet you can guess what's going to happen, Casey.
My guess is that some body of ice is going to munch on all of the things that they need.
If things start going south, no pun intended. So the very next day, they're across a crevasse, and first Mertz goes across. He's on skis, no problem. His weight's widely distributed on the skis. Then Mawson goes across, no problem. He's standing on one of these sledges being pulled by dogs, and his weight is distributed on the sledge, and he goes across. But then Ninnis goes across this, it's like a snow bridge over a crevasse. But then Ninnis goes across, and he's running alongside his sledge. So the weight is not as evenly distributed. And for whatever reason, this sort of snow bridge over the crevasse collapses, and Ninnis and his dogs and the sledge with most of the food and all the important stuff falls into the crevasse, at least about 150 feet down into the crevasse.
So what you're saying is it's enough to kill all of the dogs and Ninnis in one fell swoop.
Yes. And eat up all of their, most of their rations and survival equipment.
That had to be pretty catastrophic.
Yeah, it was catastrophic. And they instantly recognized, okay, we're in trouble. And not only that, it was the six best dogs. Which, again, why did they put the six best dogs together and the six worst dogs together? There were some questionable leadership decisions here that in later years, people that have really dug into this story have analyzed some of the decision-making.
I wonder if decision-making in these circumstances is just not great because you're cold, you're constantly hungry, you're battling all of these elements, all of the things that could be going against you are. So it's not like, it's easy to make judgments from our warm homes, you know what I mean? We're well-fed.
Yeah. 110 years later.
Right. It probably contributed in some way.
Yeah. Yeah. You probably lose some of your judgment in those moments. You're just trying to survive, just trying to make it through the next day. Austin and Mertz, they belly crawl back to this crevasse to peek over the edge and see what they can see. And they see the busted up sledge. They see a dead dog. They see a live but howling, writhing dog. This is all 150 feet down. And then they see a deeper chasm next to the ledge that the dogs are on. And they never actually even see Ninnis or his body. He just was eaten up deep into this crevasse, never to be seen again. So they did a little memorial service, the two of them there at the side of the crevasse for Ninnis. And then they just started to reevaluate. And they realized, okay, there's two of us, Mawson and Murch, left with one sledge and about 10 days of food supply for a journey that if they turned back right now would take at least a month, at least 30 days. 10 days food for a 30-day journey, two men down to six dogs and one sledge.
Oh my goodness, that's a disaster.
Yes, and they knew it. The writing was on the wall. It was clear to them they needed to turn back. That was their only chance of making it out alive. And they also knew that just the night before, they had divided up the gear off of the three sledges and onto the two. So there was, they left a third sledge behind. So they thought, okay, we're just going to turn back and go to back to where we left that sledge. There's nothing on it, but still at least it would be another sledge, if that could be helpful. So they turn back and they do make it. They went for something like 27 hours straight to get back to where they left that third sledge. They get to it. And 10 days food, 30 days. Anyone can do the math and figure out that doesn't add up. They got to find another food source. Any guesses of what they're thinking at this point? You got it. Yeah, they got six scrawny husky dogs with them. So it doesn't take long. Actually, it's within a few days that they agree their best angle at this point is to start eating the dogs.
Aside from the fact that that's going to slow them down considerably.
It's going to slow them down, and it does. And they also consider, well, the dogs are going to have to eat the dogs too, because we're going to need some of the stronger dogs to help us travel. So they start with one of the weakest dogs, and they're killing the dogs one by one and feeding the yucky parts of the dog to the remaining dogs, and they're eating the best parts of the dogs themselves. So one of the best parts of the dog is the dog's liver, and this is where it gets interesting. Xavier Mertz really did not like the taste of the stringy meat and the chewy bits of the dog. So he ate a lot more of the dog's liver because it was easier to eat. And Douglas Mawson didn't eat as much of the liver because he tolerated some of the other parts a little bit better. Well, they didn't know, and I didn't know until I looked read into this, that apparently husky dogs' livers contain really high quantities of vitamin A. Did you know that?
I did not know that, but I guess generally speaking, you think about what the liver does as an organ. And I would also think from that perspective, it could be a little bit toxic.
Yeah. Well, apparently it is. So too much vitamin A is not good for humans. It can cause this condition called hypervitaminosis A. Just as too much vitamin A, and you know, left unchecked, it causes some pretty awful symptoms: stomach pains, diarrhea, dizziness, nausea, and then it can affect brain function, cognitive function, irrational behavior, delusions, confusion, dementia. It affects the skin, hair, and nails. They talked about how their skin started falling off. And so they were experiencing these symptoms and didn't know why. And Mertz was experiencing them a lot more dramatically than Mawson chronicles in his journal, just this pretty rapid deterioration of Mertz's mental and physical condition as they were eating these dogs.
That is horrendous. Especially being out there with horrible
yes.
conditions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There was a lot of descriptions of multiple episodes of diarrhea in a day that like Mawson had to help Mertz clean up, and then it would just happen again. I mean, awful stuff in the sleeping bag. And then, of course, he just described that he noticed Mertz was just going mad, as they would say back then. Madness was taking hold of his mind. One example of that is at one point, Mertz refused to believe that he had frostbite on the tip of one of his fingers, and he bit off the tip of his own little finger.
Oh my gosh, that would be horrifying to watch.
Yeah, we're just completely irrational. So his irrationality deteriorated into rage, and he was breaking tent poles and raging. And Mawson at one point had to like sit on his chest and hold him down and keep him from damaging and tearing apart their tent. Eventually, he slipped into seizures, coma, and on the evening of January 8th, so about 2 months after they left on this expedition, left base camp, and about 1 month after Ninnis had fallen into the crevasse, Mertz died. He supposedly had died in his sleep.
What's your preferred demise? Falling into a crevasse or vitamin A toxicity?
I'm going to go with the crevasse on this one. Sounds a lot quicker.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah, I think you didn't see it coming, whereas this was a drawn-out affair here.
Option A, please.
Yeah. Okay, so now Mertz has died, and Mawson comments in his journal that he himself is so weak and starved that there seems little chance that he will get back. So he, at this point, just really thinks it's a matter of time before he also dies. And then there's some question in more recent accounts of this experience as to whether or not Mawson might have eaten some cannibalism going on. I mean, you have to question if that is something that occurred. And some historians have suggested that they think that did happen, because Mawson wrote in his journal that before heading off, after Mertz had died, he, quote, boiled all the rest of the dog meat. But it's also noted in his journal that they had shot the last dog about 2 weeks earlier. So it was really unlikely that there was any meat left. So some historians are saying, what actually were you boiling before you headed off after Mertz died? But after all of this, in 1915, a U.S. journalist had reportedly asked Mawson directly if he had considered eating Mertz's body. And Mawson said he did briefly consider it, but he decided against it because it would, quote, always leave a bad taste in his mouth. So,
but also you would have to wonder if he had any thought about whether or not that would be even safe based upon the symptoms that Mertz was experiencing.
Yeah, I get the impression from this that they had no idea that it had anything to do with the toxic liver. I think that was all retrospective information. So kind of sounds like he might not have been thinking of that.
Well, I'm just saying, if we were trekking somewhere and you had all sorts of bizarre symptoms that led to seizure and death, I might take a moment to think about what you were contaminated with potentially. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, so what I'm hearing you say is that if I weren't having bizarre symptoms before death, then it would be a no-brainer. Well, there'd be no hesitation.
I'm not saying that. I would definitely majorly hesitate. Even eating dog, I would hesitate.
I will tell you, Casey, if we're ever in this situation, you have my permission.
Right back at you. I'm wanting you to live, Julie.
Yeah, I want to be used, you know, I'm an organ donor. Okay, yeah. So Mawson denied that ever happened, but there's been some questions surrounding the truth behind that. Okay, so back to our story here. Mawson has, at this point, 100 miles to go by himself with no dogs to reach the safety of the base camp, where there is plenty of food and resources. And on top of that, he has a deadline. They had all agreed that the boat was going to turn around and go back to Antarctica on January 15th. So if he doesn't get there by January 15th, he knows the boat will be gone. And who knows? You know, he's left there.
When they were headed towards their exploration on Antarctica, you said that they were clocking about 10 miles per day with all the dogs, right? Of course, they had a lot more equipment to carry and whatnot, but that's at least, it's going to be more than 10 days, probably.
Yeah, at this point, when he's by himself and he's so weakened, he's getting at most 4 miles a day. That's his rate of travel. So he just knows he's probably not going to make that deadline. And some days he's totally snowed in. Like there's one day where they talked about they didn't even leave the tent for 24 hours because of the blizzard conditions. And he's also fallen into crevasses on his way back. He fell into like 3 different crevasses and the sledge stopped him from falling because it got wedged in the top of the crevasse. So he's like dangling from the sledge by a rope in the huge bottomless crevasse and has to crawl up the rope to get to the sledge, pull the sledge out of the crevasse. That happened more than once, apparently.
Please remind me never to complain again, Julie.
Yeah. Yeah, it just feels like a death march. And in his mind, he's thinking, I'm not going to make it out of this alive. But he does eventually get one stroke of luck. He comes across a stash of food and a note that was left by a search party that had come from his expedition group to look for these 3 explorers. The message had been left just the previous day by the search party, and the note let Masa know that he was now only about 24 miles from the base camp at Denison. And there was some food, so it gave him hope. And he just got a little bit of renewed energy to keep slogging on. And so eventually on February 8th, this is now 1913, in his ravaged physical state, he reached the final approach to where he could see the base camp. And he looked out on the water. And off in the distance, just a little blip on the horizon, he sees his ship called the Aurora. And it was
headed
back to Antarctica.
No.
Yeah, it's gone. But he can still see it. So they had left.
I was just going to say, this is when you really need a rescue flare more than any other time.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Just desperation. I'm sure at that point he was just wishing for death. So they had left a party. Let me hold on one sec. They had left a party of 6 men waiting for him at the base. They didn't just totally abandon him. They left 6 people. The boat had to get out of there because it wouldn't survive the winter and it wouldn't be able to come back until the following summer. So that was the plan all along. But they left 6 men who apparently agreed to just hang out at this base camp for a year, waiting for this team to come back. And when the men saw Mawson roll into camp, they tried to call the boat back with some rudimentary communication system. But the boat couldn't, the conditions were such that the boat couldn't turn around. It had to go. They'd waited till the last possible moment. So the boat kept going, and these 7 now men knew that they were there to stay for another year. They were going to be there, and the boat would come back in a year.
I cannot imagine. Okay, any volunteers to stay here for a year on Antarctica? We'll be back in a year, I promise.
Yeah, who would sign up for that? They must have had some real hazard pay or some kind of system in place. So in the end, Mawson did say that he actually felt like that maybe was a blessing in disguise because he was so just traumatized and worked over by this whole experience that he does say that having a year to like process what he had been through and in a low-key environment surrounded by a small group of people, you know, maybe helped him work through some of the mental trauma that he endured. Whereas if he had made the ship and was immediately thrust back into a high profile return to Australia, it might not have gone as well. And then the other thing is that they had this year to actually do a lot of scientific work. That really is what made most of this expedition be regarded as a success. For example, they studied this electro-atmospheric phenomenon of the Aurora Australis, which is known as the Southern Lights. And they were the first team to discover meteorites in Antarctica. And they also were able to make some of the wireless equipment that they had brought with them work at a really long range. So they were the first team to connect the Antarctic continent to the outside world by radio, which was a feat that they accomplished in that year that they were waiting for the boat to come back. So in the end, in February 1914, a year after his return to the base camp, the boat came back, got them all, and they sailed back to Australia, the port of Adelaide, to a hero's welcome. He was knighted. He was offered a teaching position at the University of Adelaide and was a professor of geology for the rest of his career, and went on to write a book about this experience and tell the world what he endured. Interestingly, the whole time he was gone, he was engaged to an upper-class Australian woman who waited for him to come back. So upon his return, they got married and had two daughters that also ended up carrying on his legacy in different ways after he died. He lived 76 years old, died in the 1950s of a brain hemorrhage, a stroke. So lived a pretty full life.
That's pretty impressive, Julie.
Yeah, he actually later returned to Antarctica on other research expeditions. I don't think they were as adventurous as this one.
Of course he did. Well, they all do that.
They just go back for more.
You're like, was it really that bad? I can't remember. Let's go check it out again.
Yeah, I feel like the details are hazy. So let's just go see what happens this time around. It might be better.
Oh my gosh, that had to be some of the bleakest days that any human has lived through on Earth.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Of all the stories we've told, this is one that I would not want to relive.
How many days was he out there by himself trying to make it back to camp?
Yeah, good question. So the three of them left the rest of the group on November 10th. Ninnis died on December 13th. And Mertz died on January 8th. So it's kind of like 1 month blocks. The three of them were together for about a month. The two of them were together for about a month. And then Mawson was on his own from January 8th until February 8th, a full month, trying to make it back solo.
So he basically had 2 months of trying to get back, right?
Yeah. Yep. 2 months of desperate dog eating, partner going mad, trying to get back, blizzard traveling, crevasse falling into, nightmare.
That's a very long time.
It sure is.
All right. Well, you haven't really inspired me too much to get to a cold location at this point, Julie. Really good story.
Yeah, it's a good one. I'd go to Antarctica on a comfy ship. I would love to go to Antarctica now, modern day, with all the amenities there. It sounds like a great adventure, but maybe not 100 years ago.
No. My friend Arielle actually is working in Antarctica as a PA. She's been going every summer season for about the past 4 seasons or so.
Yeah. I would love to do that, actually. That sounds awesome.
Yeah. We'll have to have her listen to this episode and see if she ever heard of this Mawson character before.
Yeah, I bet she had. His legacy is commemorated in a lot of different ways. There's been a big project to restore the huts that they built at Cape Denison. He was on one of the Australian dollar bills for a while. There's a lot of things named Mawson in Australia after him. He's a name out there as a result of all this.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Crux True Survival Stories podcast. We hope these stories of resilience and triumph have left you inspired and reminded of the incredible strength that humans possess. If you have your own survival story to share or burning questions you'd like us to explore, don't hesitate to reach out to us at thecruxpodcast@gmail.com. We're always eager to hear from our listeners and continue the conversation. Stay updated on all things The Crux by following us on Instagram @thecruxpodcast.
Your support means the world to us, and we'd be truly grateful if you'd just take a moment to write a review of the podcast or share it with a friend. Spreading the word helps us reach more listeners and share these remarkable tales of survival with even a wider audience. Wishing you a fantastic Monday and an incredible week ahead. Until the next episode, stay safe, stay curious, and keep the flame of survival burning bright. Thank you for being part of the Crux community.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a savory sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and crispy hash browns. With McDonald's Mix and Match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Let's say your small business has a problem. Like maybe... one of your doggy daycare customers had an accident. You might say something like,
doggone it!
Hi, Chihuahua!
Holy schnauzers!
But if you need someone who can actually help, just say,
like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
And get help filing a claim from your local State Farm agent. For your small business insurance needs, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
If a friend asks how you're doing, and you say,
I'm okay.
When the truth is,
I don't want my problems to burden anyone.
Or you say,
hang in there.
Because
if I ask for help, they'll just think I'm weak.
Then this is your sign to call, text, or chat. 988 for free, confidential support. Anytime. You don't have to hide how you feel.
1, 2, 3, 4. Those are numbers. But you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.